This is Pursuing Justice. I'm your host, Harriet Hendel. We so often speak about wrongful conviction on my program, but today we will be discussing wrongful convictions that occurred, but no crime was committed. Our guest today is Professor Jessica S. Henry from Montclair State University in Montclair, New Jersey, my alma mater, where I earned my master's degree way back in the 70s. Professor Henry is an author, blogger, legal commentator, and social justice advocate. Her JD is from NYU School of Law, and she served as a public defender in New York City for almost a decade. She was awarded the 2022 University Distinguished Scholar Award in recognition of her outstanding scholarship. She teaches classes on wrongful conviction, criminal law, hate crimes, and death penalty perspectives. Her new book, Smoke But No Fire, Convicting the Innocent of Crimes That Never Happened, came out in 2020. Welcome, Jessica, to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Now, the title of your book certainly is the reason I bought it. It's intriguing. What is its meaning?
Yeah, so I think we all heard the expression, where there's smoke, there must be fire. But that's actually not true. Sometimes there's just smoke. And in the context of cases where innocent people are wrongly convicted of crimes that never actually occurred in the first place, we see that coming to life.
So we're going to delve into that far, far more deeply. So let's begin, because you cite a case of no crime wrongful conviction dating all the way back to 1812 in the state of Vermont. Can you tell us a little more about that particular case?
Yeah. So there were two brothers, Jesse and Stephen Bourne, and they were accused of murdering their brother-in-law who had vanished. And there was no evidence, so they initially weren't charged. But then one night, a townsperson had a dream. And in the dream, the missing brother-in-law came to them and said, "I'm buried in the Bourne basement." And the townspeople took that as significant. And they searched the cellar basement, and there were no bones there. But a young boy happened to be digging by a tree near the Bourne farm and found bones. And the townspeople were like, "Oh, this is the evidence we need." And they arrested the two brothers. So while they were in jail pending their quote unquote trial, the townspeople discovered that the bones were actually animal. So we have our first instance of forensic error right there. But the townspeople were undeterred, and they somehow got a confession from Jesse Bourne. And then a jailhouse snitch came forward. And then the second brother, in an effort to exonerate Jesse's, said that he, in fact, had done the whole thing himself. And the brothers were tried and sentenced to die. And while they were pending their execution, waiting for their hanging, a reverend in New Jersey saw the image of the missing brother-in-law and said, "Wait a second, I know this guy. He lives in New Jersey." And the brothers were exonerated.
Oh my gosh, what a story.
No murder had ever occurred.
How long were they locked up before the case was dismissed?
I'm not sure. A few years, I believe.
Wow. And they could have been put to death, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the brothers' sentences actually had been reduced to a life term, but the other brother was facing hanging.
Mm. Amazing that even as far back as 1812, we have this whole issue. It's incredible. So the National Registry of Exoneration, I mention it probably almost every time I'm on the air. I love their website. Tells us, according to your book, that a third of exonerations stem from crimes that never happened. Is that currently accurate, that figure?
Actually, no. It's even worse than that. Almost 40% of all cases in the National Registry of Exonerations, meaning all known exonerations, almost 40% involve crimes that never happened in the first place. And that one third number that you just mentioned is actually how this book came to be written in the first place. I couldn't believe it. I'm a scholar of wrongful convictions. I've been teaching and writing about it for a very long time. And when I was playing one day, as it sounds like you do as well, playing around in the data at the National Registry of Exonerations, I saw that no crime wrongful convictions accounted for one third at the time. And I thought, that can't be right. There must be something wrong with the coding. So I emailed with them and I had a whole correspondence. And in fact, 1/3 of all cases, in fact, involved crimes that never happened. And I thought, that's wild, because most people understand a wrongful conviction to involve someone who is wrongly accused of a crime that is committed by someone else, and then they wrongly are convicted. But I couldn't get my head around the fact that all of these folks were wrongly accused and then wrongly convicted of crimes that literally never happened. Wild.
It certainly, is. Well, let's talk about the case more current than 1812 of Sabrina Butler. What about her case?
That's a terrible case. It happened in 1989 in Mississippi. Sabrina Butler was a 17-year-old single mom, and she walked into a room and saw the unthinkable. Her baby boy was not breathing. And she ran and grabbed a neighbor and frantically and clumsily tried to do CPR. She didn't really know how. And then she rushed her little boy to the emergency room, and the emergency personnel could not revive him, and he was pronounced dead. And the folks at the hospital were very suspicious because he had abdominal bruising, and they decided that the cause of death must have been abuse, and they contacted the police. And the police, instead of treating Miss Butler as the grieving young mother that she was, treated her as a murder suspect and harshly interrogated her for hours until she finally made statements that they called admissions, and she was prosecuted. And not only was she prosecuted, but she was convicted and sentenced to die. She spent 5 years on Mississippi's death row before she was ultimately exonerated because, one, the abdominal bruising was caused by the poorly administered CPR, and two, the child had an undiagnosed kidney disorder that could have caused his death. And so, again, we have an example of a young person or a person being accused and convicted of a horrible crime, treated just terribly by an indifferent and cruel system, who was ultimately exonerated because no crime had ever occurred.
And there again, she was on death row. Wasn't she unique in that she was the only woman?
She was the only woman on Mississippi's death row. Yeah.
Horrible. Just absolutely horrible. Another case is Betty Mizzy. That's like a nickname. Patterson from Philadelphia.
Yeah, this is a sort of on the opposite end of the spectrum because it didn't involve a crime of violence and it didn't involve medical misdiagnosis. This is an example where the police planted evidence. So Ms. Patterson, who's now a reverend, so I'll call her Reverend Patterson.
Okay.
She was 54 years old. She was a grandma and she lived in Philadelphia. And she wound up, believe it or not, being charged and convicted of dealing in crack cocaine from her home, running a drug den. And it turns out that the police had come to her house and planted evidence because they were suspicious that one of her three sons was involved in a drug-related murder. And they planted the drugs in an effort to get her to talk or get her sons to talk. And of course, it backfired tremendously. And so she spent, as I said, 3 years in prison. That case is very interesting because the officers were ultimately convicted of a whole bunch of criminal misconduct. And that almost never happens. So there is a slight justice light that came out of this, but not before someone's life was incredibly damaged.
Yeah. Do you recall the time frame of that particular case?
It was in the early 1990s.
Oh, okay. 1990s. Then we have 48 defendants from Tulia, Texas. What was that story?
So this is in 1999 in Tulia, Texas, this little sleepy town. And, you know, the black population. Oh, you know what? Before I even get there, before we talk about Tulia, can I just say, I want to make a note because this is an important theme. Both Sabrina Butler and Reverend Patterson and almost all of the 48 defendants who were wrongly convicted in Tulia, Texas were black. And it's really important to highlight that because racism is so prevalent. Anytime we have conversations, of course, about the criminal legal system, and in particular in some of these cases where the police are able to exercise their authority against poor communities, and particularly poor communities of color. And I would be remiss of me not to kind of highlight that as we continue this conversation, because in Tulia, Texas, it was absolutely a story that was laced in part with racism. Tom Coleman was a white undercover officer, although he wasn't particularly well accredited. He had been brought in specifically to investigate a drug problem in Tulia, Texas that frankly nobody seemed to really know about. And based solely on Tom Coleman's say-so, he was this undercover guy who had assumed this persona and he flashed around cash. He alleged that 48 people were selling drugs. And it was kind of horrific because the newspaper in Tulia flashed a headline saying Tulia's street is cleared of garbage. And the photo for which that was captioned involved all of these people who were woken in the middle of the night and paraded through the streets, sometimes in their pajamas, you know, just to highlight how effective Coleman was. In fact, Coleman won the Texas Lawman of the Year Award for his efforts in Tulia, except for it turns out he was just making things up. There was no one to corroborate Coleman. He was the sole source of these allegations. He would take notes on his leg that got washed off in the shower. So the first group of Tulia defendants tried to fight the charges against them because they were innocent and they attempted to use the legal process to clear their names. And instead, they were convicted based solely again on Tom Coleman's words and sentenced to horrific terms of prison. And the rest of the Tulia defendants watched what had happened and all pled guilty. And it wasn't until a little bit later that some of Tom Coleman's allegations just kind of fell apart at the seams. For instance, there was an allegation that this one woman was selling drugs when she was in fact at a bank out of state with the receipt from the bank that completely showed that what he was saying was false. And so eventually, all of those cases were overturned. And in 2005, Coleman was convicted of perjury and sentenced to probation.
Probation, not prison.
Probation. And again, that was somewhat of an unusual outcome because most of the time folks don't ever get held responsible at all.
How long did it take to clear the people from the case in Tulia, Texas? Do you know?
A few years. So the initial allegations, you know, the folks were arrested in 1999. So a few years. I don't quite know the exact timeline. 2002, 2003?
So not, fortunately, decades, which often happens.
Right, which does often happen.
Especially when an Innocence Project steps in. It's never quick. It's always a
right.
long...
In this case, it wasn't actually an Innocence Project. It was the Texas NAACP and a private attorney and a couple other folks who got involved.
I see.
Something really went wrong in Tulia, Texas. And thankfully, there were enough people who were outraged by it that they went in and investigated. But obviously, it shouldn't have happened in the first place.
Do you think because there were so many defendants that had an impact on the case?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it really just didn't pass the sniff test. it didn't. And when you look at who was being arrested and from what part of town, it was a very concentrated effort. And the evidence was so flimsy that it didn't really pass scrutiny.
You mentioned racism. Do you think that cases in places like Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, the idea of the South, is that a factor as well?
It can be, absolutely. But it wouldn't be fair to say that it's limited solely to the South.
No.
I mean, Reverend Patterson, for instance, was in Philadelphia. There's been tremendous police corruption that has resulted in wrongful convictions in Chicago, in Baltimore, Maryland, in Camden, New Jersey. I mean, we can kind of go up and down the Eastern Seaboard. So, and of course, in Los Angeles, the Rampart scandal. So there's tons and tons of instances where police misconduct has resulted in wrongful convictions of large swaths of people, all of whom, or many of whom, I shouldn't say all of whom, many of whom are poor people of color.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I've interviewed Dr. Saul Kassin, who is an expert in the field of false confessions. You state that confession evidence has more of an impact on trial verdicts than other forms of evidence. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, you know, false confessions really only occur in the context of no crime wrongful convictions in about, I think it's 5% of cases, but it's very powerful and impactful evidence because when a jury hears that the defendant themselves admitted to wrongdoing, it takes some of the pressure off of them. Then they don't have to decide because the defendant said they did it. You know, I teach a course on wrongful convictions, as I think I mentioned, and I always ask my students, how many of you think that you would falsely admit to a crime you did not commit? Mm. And nobody raises their hand. Nobody thinks that they would ever admit to something they didn't do. And that's in part because people don't understand the pressures of police interrogation or the pressures of being faced with a choice to plead guilty, admit guilt for something you didn't do versus rolling the dice and maybe facing years and years and years in prison. And so it's something that's very unintuitive and that jurors love to hear.
Tough, very. And I think from my reading, often that happens to young people, teens, who are being questioned, and often there's not counsel there nor a parent, and they're promised, well, if you just tell us what happened, you can go home. And they buy that, and then they say, oh, yes, I did do it. It's very, very sad that a teen's life can be ruined with just one confession.
Yeah. And I mean, it is often teens, but it isn't limited to teens, no. Right? I mean, it's just being interrogated by the police can be a very overwhelming process for even the most mature adult. But obviously, there are folks who are more vulnerable to giving false confessions than others, right? So people with intellectual disabilities, people who are grieving, people who are young, to your point, right. People with mental illness. So there's a whole host of folks who are more vulnerable. People even who have compliant personalities, you know, don't like conflict, can be more vulnerable to a false confession.
Yeah, and it's very intimidating when the police use their good cop, bad cop approach, the Reed approach to questioning, and someone is feeling, well, I just want to do the right thing, and the right thing is not confession, but that's what ends up happening. So another key topic that I know I've spoken about before on this program, but it certainly bears repeating, is cognitive bias. And how does something like that, if you would explain what that is in case people haven't listened before, and how does cognitive bias impact a case?
Cognitive biases are not necessarily a bad thing, right? It's an umbrella term. It comes from psychology, and it helps explain the way that humans make judgments and decisions. It's the unconscious process that influences that decision making. And the truth is, we're flooded with information. So we often take shortcuts known as heuristics to try to make sense of a lot of information. And in the context of criminal justice, what we see is that decision makers, for instance, police officers or medical folks in the emergency room, as was the case with Sabrina Butler, they make quick decisions that are influenced by biases that they have unconsciously that color the rest of the case. And so, you know, when Sabrina Butler brought in her child to the emergency room and they saw bruising, they immediately leapt to the conclusion that a murder had occurred instead of doing any further forensic analysis that would have revealed a kidney disorder. And then the police engaged in a guilt presumptive interrogation that sort of enticed her, or induced her rather, to make statements that weren't even true. And so that tunnel vision can have a tremendous impact on how the police approach a case. They will overemphasize things that support their theory of guilt. They'll minimize the evidence that might otherwise suggest innocence. And they go through their investigation with that mindset. And then they inform the prosecution, who then also share the potential tunnel vision, and do the same thing. They minimize or ignore evidence that doesn't support their theory of the case, and they lean heavily on evidence, even questionable evidence, that will help them establish guilt.
Yeah. This seems to happen, I think, a great deal to women with cases of, quote, shaken baby syndrome, right? The Innocence Project of Florida was able to help two women, both of them accused of shaken baby. And there again, no crime happened. It was a medical issue that was not recognized, very much similar to Sabrina, her case. Do you ever find out how some of these people that you write about are doing? Like, for instance, Sabrina, do you know how she recovered from?
You know, I actually had the pleasure of talking with her.
Oh, really?
I brought her over Zoom to my class, and she's doing okay. I mean, she is married and she is out and she is, you know, trying to create a project, I believe last time when she was there, that will help other people who were wrongly incarcerated. So that was a couple years ago, but she seemed like, you know, but obviously forever traumatized, not only by the loss of her son, but by how the system treated her.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. Another example of that is someone I also interviewed, Christine Bunch, similar, okay, but this was a fire in which her toddler died, and she was accused of setting the fire. So, you know, the impact of being wrongfully convicted and grieving, and she spent 17 years behind bars, just so sad.
Cameron Todd Willingham. I mean, is obviously a sort of a more famous arson murder conviction. He was executed for the arson murder of his three children, again, for a fire that was not an intentional fire. It was never an arson. It wasn't. It was an accidental fire. And when we see that, it's shocking that people are held accountable for non-criminal events as if a crime had occurred.
Yeah. Well, fire science has come a long way since Willingham's case and Christine's as well. But it's really frightening to think that you can be accused of something so horrible as setting a fire when it wasn't something that you did anyway. You know, we're not.
Yeah, and arson is one of those very complex kinds of crimes, right? Because the fire itself consumes the evidence.
That's right.
And a lot of evidence that would support the theory that there was an arson also supports the theory that it was an accident. So even though fire science has come a long way, I still think it is a science that we need to be very careful about when we look at how and why people are accused of arson.
Well, we are out of time, Professor, and I know you said you would return to talk to us some more about your book and this whole issue of no crime conviction. So we will sign off and welcome you back next time on Pursuing Justice. And as we sign off, I want to thank Professor Henry for coming on to Pursuing Justice. And thanks to the Innocence Project of Florida for sponsoring my podcast, and to my producer at the Pod Cabin, Jordan Moore. Thanks for spending time with us today, and please join us next time on Pursuing Justice.